Ayrım 16.
Sayfa 191. Kant takes the existence of an ordinary moral consciousness for granted. His own parents, whose sacrifices had made his education possible, and whose intellectual gifts were notably less than his own, seemed to him models of simple goodness. When Kant read Rousseau, Rousseau's remarks on the dignity of ordinary human nature struck home at once. It is the moral consciousness of this ordinary human nature which provides the philosopher with an object for analysis. As in the theory of knowledge, the philosopher's task is not to seek for a basis or a vindication, but to ask what character our moral concepts and precepts must have to make morality as it is possible. Kant, therefore, is among those philosophers who see their task as one of post-eventum analysis. Science is what it is, morality is what it is, and there's an end on it. This essentially conservative view is all the more surprising when we recall that Kant's lifetime, 1724-1804, was a period of rapid social change. Part of the explanation of Kant's attitudes is perhaps biographical. Königsberg, near Prussia's eastern limits, was no metropolis, and Kant led an isolated academic existence. But much more important is the fact that Kant conceived his task as the isolation of the a priori, and therefore unchanging, elements of morality. In different societies, there might be different moral schemes. Kant insisted on his own students coming to terms with the empirical study of human nature. But what is it that makes these schemes moral? What form must a precept have if it is to be recognized as a moral precept? Kant approaches this question from an initial assertion that nothing is unconditionally good except a goodwill. Health, wealth, intellect are good only insofar as they are used well. But the goodwill is good. It shines forth like a precious jewel, even if, through the niggardly provision of a stepmotherly nature, the agent is insufficiently strong, rich, or clever to bring about desirable states of affairs. Attention is thus focused from the outset on the agent's will, on his motives and intentions, rather than upon what he actually does. What motives or intentions make the goodwill good? The goodwill's only motive is to do its duty for the sake of doing its duty. Whatever it intends to do, it intends because it is its duty. A man may do what is, in fact, his duty from quite another motives. A shopkeeper giving the correct change may be honest, not because it is his duty to be honest, but because honesty pays off by bringing him custom and increasing his profits. But it is important to note here that a will can fail to be good, not only because duty may be done from self-interested motives, but also because duty may be done from altruistic motives, which nonetheless spring from inclination. If I am a friendly, cheerful, kind person by nature, who enjoys helping others, my altruistic acts, which may be what duty in fact demands from me, may be done not because duty demands them, but just because I have an inclination to behave in this way. I enjoy it. If so, my will fails to be decisively good, just as if I had acted from self-interest. Kant rarely mentions and never dwells upon the difference between inclinations to act in one way rather than another. The whole contrast is between duty upon the one hand and inclination of every kind upon the other. For inclination belongs to our determined physical and psychological nature. We cannot, in Kant's view, choose our inclinations. What we can do is to choose between our inclination and our duty. How then does duty present itself to me? It presents itself as obedience to a law that is universally binding on all rational beings. What is the content of this law, and how do I become aware of it? I become aware of it as a set of precepts which, in prescribing to myself, I can consistently will should be obeyed by all rational beings. The test of a genuine moral imperative is that I can universalize it, that is, that I can will that it should be a universal law, or, as Kant puts it in another formulation, that I can will that it should be a law of nature. The point of this latter formulation is to stress that not only must I be able to will that the precept in question should be recognized as a law universally, but I must also be able to will that it should be acted on universally, in the appropriate circumstances. The sense of be able to and can in these formulations is equivalent to can without inconsistency, the demand for consistency being part of the demand for rationality, in a law that men prescribe to themselves as rational beings. Kant's most helpful example is that of promise keeping. Suppose that I am tempted to break a promise. The precept upon which I am considering acting may be formulated as, I may always break a promise when it is in my interest to do so. Can I consistently will that this precept should be universally acknowledged and acted upon? If all men acted upon this precept and broke their promises whenever it suited them, clearly the practices of making and of relying upon promises would break down, for nobody would be able to trust the promises of others, and consequently utterances of the form I promised to would cease to have point. Hence, to will that this precept should be universalized is to will that promise-keeping should no longer be possible. But to will that I should be able to act on this precept, which I must will, as part of willing that the precept should be universalized, is to will that I should be able to make promises and break them, and this is to will that the practice of promise-keeping should continue, so that I can take advantage of it. Hence, to will that this precept should be universalized is to will both that promise-keeping as a practice should continue and also that it should not. So I cannot universalize this precept consistently, and thus it cannot be a true moral imperative, or as Kant calls it, a categorical imperative. In calling moral imperatives categorical, Kant contrasts them with hypothetical imperatives. A hypothetical imperative is of the form, you ought to do such and such if... The if may introduce either of two types of condition. There are hypothetical imperatives of skill, you ought to do such and such, or do such and such if you wish to produce this sort of result, e.g., press the switch if you wish to ring the bell, and hypothetical imperatives of prudence. You ought to do such and such if you wish to be happy or for your advantage. The categorical imperative is limited by no conditions. It is simply of the form, you ought to do such and such. A version of Kant's categorical imperative certainly appears in ordinary moral utterance in our society. You ought to do it. Why? There is no reason, you just ought. The force of there is no reason is to draw a contrast with the cases where you ought to do something because it will be to your pleasure or advantage or will bring out some result you want. Thus, the distinction between categorical and hypothetical imperatives is at this level a familiar one. What is unfamiliar is the Kantian test of ability to universalize the precept consistently. For what is not present in our everyday moral discourse is the concept of a rational, and because rational, objective, criterion for deciding which are the authentic moral imperatives. The historical importance of Kant is partly that his criterion is designed to replace two alternative criteria. According to Kant, the rational being utters the commands of morality to himself. He obeys no one but himself. Obedience is not automatic because we are not wholly rational beings, but are compounded of reason and of what calls sensibility, in which is included all our physiological and psychological makeup. Kant contrasts what he calls pathological love, by which he means not morbid or unnatural love, but natural affection, the love that springs up in us spontaneously, with the love that can be commanded, which is obedience to the categorical imperative, and which he equates with the love for our neighbor that Jesus commanded. But Jesus cannot be for us a moral authority, or rather, he is only in so far as our rational nature recognizes him as such and accords him authority. And if that is the authority which we accept, it is in fact our own reason and not Jesus, which we are taking to be ultimately authoritative. We can put the same point in another way. Suppose that a divine being, real or alleged, commands me to do something. I only ought to do what he commands if what he commands is right. But if I am in a position to judge for myself whether what he commands is right or not, then I have no need of the divine being to instruct me in what I ought to do. Inescapably, each of us is his own moral authority. To recognize this, which Kant calls the autonomy of the moral agent, is to recognize also that external authority, even if divine, can provide no criterion for morality. To suppose that it could would be to be guilty of heteronomy, of the attempt to subject the agent to a law outside himself, aligned to his nature as a rational being. But belief in a divine law as the source of morality is not the only kind of heteronomy. If we attempt to find a criterion for assessing moral precepts in the concept of happiness or of what would satisfy human wants and needs, we shall be equally wrong-headed. The realm of inclination is as alien to our rational natures as any divine commandments are. Hence, Aristotle's eudaimonia is as useless for morality as Christ's law. It is useless in any case because it can provide no fixed guide. The notion of happiness is indefinitely variable, depending upon variations in psychological makeup. But the moral law must be entirely unvarying. When I have discerned a categorical imperative, I have discerned a rule which has no exceptions. In a short essay called On the Supposed Right of Telling a Lie from Benevolent Motives, Kant replied to Benjamin Constant, who had criticized him on this point. Suppose that a would-be murderer inquires from me the whereabouts of his intended victim, and suppose that I lie in order to save the victim. The murderer then proceeds to follow my directions, but, unknown to me, the victim has in fact removed himself to precisely the place to which I have directed the murderer. Consequently, the murder is effected as a consequence of my lie, and I am responsible precisely because I lied. But had I told the truth, I could not have been held responsible no matter what happened. For it is my duty to obey the imperative and not to look to the consequences. The resemblance of Kant's view to that of Butler is striking, and it is no accident that for Kant, as for Butler, the insistence upon the irrelevant consequences is balanced by an invocation of theology. Kant argues that my duty is my duty irrespective of the consequences, whether in this world or the next. He has none of the crudity and insensitivity of the theological utilitarians, but he still argues, or rather asserts, that it would be intolerable if in fact duty were not in the end crowned with happiness. The odd thing is that if happiness is as indeterminate a notion as he suggests elsewhere, and as he suggests rightly elsewhere, for the Kantian notion of happiness has been detached from any notion of socially established ends and the satisfaction to be gained from achieving them, he can scarcely be consistent here in introducing happiness as the reward of virtue, which, though unsought, being indeed the reward of virtue only if it is unsought, is that without which the whole enterprise of morality would scarcely make sense. What this amounts to is a tacit admission that without some such notion, not morality itself, but the Kantian interpretation of it scarcely makes sense. Practical reason presupposes, on Kant's view, a belief in God, freedom, and immortality. God is required as a power capable of realizing the summum bonum of crowning virtue with happiness. Immortality is required because virtue and happiness manifestly do not coincide in this life, and freedom is the presupposition of the categorical imperative. For it is only in acts of obedience to the categorical imperative that we are delivered from the bondage of our own inclinations. The oath of the categorical imperative can only have application to an agent capable of obedience. In this sense, oath implies can. And to be capable of obedience implies that one has evaded the determination of one's actions by one's inclinations simply because the imperative which guides action determined by inclination is always a hypothetical one. This is the content of moral freedom. The power of this Kantian picture is undeniable, and its power is increased rather than diminished when the doctrine of the categorical imperative is detached from the dubious support offered by the Kantian forms of belief in God and immortality. Whence does this power derive? In the course of the discussion of Hume, I described the emergence of the moral ought in the modern sense. Although we can discuss the first signs of philosophical recognition for this ought in a writer like Hume, his utilitarianism does not allow him to give it a central place. But with Kant, this ought is not only central but all-absorbing. The word duty is detached altogether from its root connection with the fulfillment of a particular role or the carrying out of the functions of a particular office. It becomes singular rather than plural, and it is defined in terms of obedience to categorical moral imperatives, that is, in terms of injunctions containing the new ought. The very detachment of the categorical imperative from contingent events and needs and from social circumstances makes it in at least two ways an acceptable form of moral precept for emerging liberal individualist society. It makes the individual morally sovereign. It enables him to reject all external authorities. And it leaves the individual free to pursue whatever it is that he does, without suggesting that he ought to do something else. This latter point is perhaps less obvious than the first. The typical examples of alleged categorical imperatives given by Kant tell us what not to do. not to break promises, tell lies, commit suicide, and so on. But as to what activities we ought to engage in, what ends we should pursue, the categorical imperative seems to be silent. Morality sets limits to the ways in which and the means by which we conduct our lives. It does not give them direction. Thus, morality apparently sanctions any way of life which is compatible with keeping our promises, telling the truth, and so on. A closely related point moves nearer to matters of directly philosophical interest. The doctrine of the categorical imperative provides me with a test for rejecting proposed maxims. It does not tell me whence I am to derive the maxims which first provide the need for a test. Thus, the Kantian doctrine is parasitic upon some already existing morality, within which it allows us to sift, or rather, within which it would allow us to sift if the test it provided were a reliable test. But in fact it is not, even on its own terms. For the Kantian test of a true moral precept is that it is one that I can consistently universalize. In fact, however, with sufficient ingenuity, almost every precept can be consistently universalized. For all that I need to do is to characterize the proposed action in such a way that the maxim will permit me to do what I want while prohibiting others from doing what would nullify the maxim if universalized. Kant asks if I can consistently universalize the maxim that I may break my promises whenever it suits me. Suppose, however, that he had inquired whether I can consistently universalize the maxim, I may break my promises only when... The gap is filled by a description devised so that it will apply to my present circumstances, but to very few others, and to none such that if someone else obeyed the maxim, it would inconvenience me, let alone show the maxim incapable of consistent universality. It follows that in practice the test of the categorical imperative imposes restrictions only on those insufficiently equipped with ingenuity. And this surely is scarcely what Kant intended. The logical emptiness of the test of the categorical imperative is itself of social importance. Because the Kantian notion of duty is so formal that it can be given almost any content, it becomes available to provide a sanction and a motive for the specific duties which any particular social and moral tradition may propose. Because it detaches the notion of duty from the notions of ends, purposes, wants, and needs, it suggests that, given a proposed course of action, I may only ask whether, in doing it, I can consistently will that it shall be universally done, and not ask what ends or purposes it serves. Anyone educated into the Kantian notion of duty will, so far, have been educated into easy conformism with authority. Nothing, of course, could be further from the intentions or from the spirit of Kant himself. His wish is to exhibit the moral individual as being a standpoint and a criterion superior to and outside any actual social order. He sympathizes with the French Revolution. He hated servility and valued independence of mind. Paternalism, so he held, was the grossest form of despotism. Footnote: on the saying, that may be all right in theory, but it is no good in practice, in Kant, edited and translated by G. Rabel. But the consequences of his doctrines, in German history at least, suggest that the attempt to find a moral standpoint completely independent of the social order may be a quest for an illusion, a quest that renders one a mere conformist servant of the social order much more than does the morality of those who recognize the impossibility of a code which does not to some extent as least express the wants and needs of men in particular social circumstances. Chapter 15. Hegel and Marx. It would be satisfying in some ways to make Hegel the culmination of the history of ethics, partly because Hegel himself saw the history of philosophy as ending with himself, more importantly because by Hegel's time all the fundamental positions have been taken up. After Hegel they reappear in new guises and with new variations, but their reappearance is a testimony to the impossibility of fundamental innovation. The young Hegel set himself a problem which has already appeared in the argument. Why are modern Germans, or Europeans in general, not like ancient Greeks? His answer is that through the rise of Christianity, the individual and the state have become divided, so that the individual looks to transcendent criteria rather than to those implicit in the practice of his own political community. Christianity separates the man whose destiny is eternal from the citizen. Its God is the ruler of the world, not the deity of heart and city. Greek ethics presupposed the shared structure of the polis and the consequent shared goals and desires. Modern 18th century communities are collections of individuals. Hegel usually writes as if the Greek polis were more harmonious than in fact it was. He often ignores the existence of slaves. But then so did Plato and Aristotle. Yet if Hegel's vision of Greek harmony is exaggerated, it provides him with clues for the diagnosis of individualism and with clues of a historical kind. For Hegel is the first author to understand that there is not a single permanent moral question. His whole philosophy is an attempt to show that the history of philosophy is at the core of philosophy. And he believes this because he believes that philosophy clarifies and articulates the same concepts which are implicit in ordinary thought and practice. Since these have a history, philosophy too must be a historical discipline. It is true that Hegel, especially in his later writings, often treats concepts as if they are timeless entities, somehow independent of the flux of the changing world. But even here there is usually some saving clause to make it clear that this is only a façon de parler. If then for Hegel the clue to ethics is in the history of ethics, the Hegelian philosophy must cover the ground already traversed in these essays and more. So it does, and in a variety of ways. The accounts of morality and its history given in the Phenomenology of Mind and in the Philosophy of Right are by no means identical. Moreover, in the Phenomenology at least, Hegel covers the same ground more than once in different ways. What I shall do, therefore, is to try to outline Hegel's general view of the history of morality and of the role of moral philosophy in that history. Then look at what is illuminating in Hegel's changes of mind, and finally criticize Hegel's own solution. Hegel envisages the most elementary forms of human life as essentially unreflective. The individual is absorbed into a closed society in which he acts out his customary role. In such a society, the questions, what shall I do, how shall I live, cannot arise. It is as I become conscious through my relationships with other people of my status as a person, apart from the roles which I fill, that room is made for these questions. As society becomes more complex, as possibilities of alternative ways of life grow, so choices multiply. But in choosing, I cannot discount the criteria of contemporary social practice. 17th and 18th century writers, like Greek sophists before them, write as if the individual with his psychologically determined passions approaches social life with ends and aims already given. For Hegel, this is a profound illusion. What passions and what ends the individual has and can have are a matter of the kind of social structure in which the individual finds himself. Desires are elicited and specified by the objects presented to them. The objects of desire, and especially of desires to live in one way rather than another, cannot be the same in all societies. But it is not necessarily the case that the desires elicited by a particular form of social life will find satisfaction within that form. The working out of the ends of contemporary practice may, in fact, destroy the very form of life which brought the desire for those ends into being. The reflective criticism of both ends and means may have unintended consequences. In the light of these considerations, Hegel pictures developed society in terms of a succession of forms of life, each of which, by a natural transition, is transformed into its successor. In the phenomenology, there is no suggestion, there is indeed a denial, that actual historical periods must rigorously follow out this pattern. Rather, the suggestion is that insofar as they do follow out this pattern, their history exhibits the logic of these Hegelian transitions. There are two particular sequences which any interpretation of Hegel must take seriously. The first of these is not specifically concerned with morality, but it is concerned with the nature of the framework within which moral questions arise. It is also an excellent introduction to Hegel's own fundamental attitudes. When the self-consciousness of individuals realizes itself in social roles, a central part is played by the relationship of master and serf. In this relationship, the master at the outset envisages himself alone as a fully self-conscious person. His serf he seeks to reduce to the level of a thing, a mere instrument. But as the relationship develops, the master too is deformed and more radically than the serf is. For the relationship is defined in terms of their relationship to material things. These provide work for the serf, but merely transient enjoyments for the master. The serf is indeed deformed, for his aims are so limited by the aims and the commands of the master that he can do little more than assert himself in the barest possible way. But the master, insofar as he seems himself as master, cannot find in the serf any response through which in turn he could find himself as a fully developed person. He has cut himself off from the kind of relationship in which self-consciousness grows through being an object of regard by others, through finding itself mirrored in others. Whereas the serf can see in the master something at least that he wants to become. But for both it is true that growth in self-consciousness is fatally limited by the master-serf relationship. Hegel then looks at three false solutions to the problem posed by that relationship. And in doing this, he is thinking back to Imperial Rome and to the attitudes engendered in a society actually dominated by the master-serf theme, not only in the institution of slavery itself, but in the relation of Caesar to his subjects and in the whole ranking of superiors and inferiors. The first false solution is Stoicism, the acceptance of necessity, the identification of oneself with the universal reason of the cosmos, whatever one's rank or relationship. Emperor and slave equally envisage themselves as citizens of the world. But this is to mask their real relationship rather than to transform it. This is to try to think away the reality of serfdom by invoking the idea of freedom. So equally with skepticism, a frame of mind which casts doubt on all received beliefs and distinctions enforced by those who are masters, but which has to exist in an individual who continues to live in that same world of received beliefs and distinctions. So the skeptic always has two attitudes of mind, one reserved for his academic reflections, in which he defies the ruling ideology, one for his daily commerce with social reality, in which he conforms to it. The dilemma of being unable to extract oneself from a social world, which deforms at one and the same time both one's relations with others and one's own personality, is finally given social expression in the form of life, which Hegel calls that of the unhappy consciousness. This is the epoch of Catholic Christianity. In it, the essential distress of the deformed, because unfree, character of human life and the consciousness of the possibility, indeed the necessity of overcoming this, are represented in the form of the contrast between the fallen world of humanity and the perfection of the divine. The ideal is seen as something transcendent, existing outside and apart from human life. In the doctrine of the atonement, the reconciliation of man as he is, with the ideal is portrayed in symbolic form. But those who remain within the symbolism and take it for a reality are thereby denied the reality which is symbolized. The Crusaders try to find the ideal in militant action. Instead of the ideal, they find a grave. The monastic orders try to find the ideal in asceticism. In so doing, they become prey to that very preoccupation with the flesh, with finitude, which they sought to escape. The way out is to see that Christianity symbolizes the human condition aptly enough, but that Christianity understood as literal truth is not the cure, but part of the disease. What condition, what cure, what disease? One might begin from the master-serf relation again. But it is important to see that this for Hegel only provides a special case of a more general feature of human life and thought. This feature is what Hegel calls the negative. This concept can be explained as follows. If we wish to understand any concept or explain any belief, we must first locate it in the system of which it is a part. This system will manifest itself both in a characteristic mode of life and in characteristic forms of theorizing. The relation between the mode of life and the theorizing will not always be the same, but to some degree the theorizing will make articulate the concepts and beliefs implicit in the mode of life. Hegel here anticipates the later treatment of religion in simpler societies by social anthropologists, and also Weber's treatment of Protestantism and capitalism. Yet, in so doing, the more conscious the agent becomes of the form of life in which he is involved as a whole, as a form of life, the more he will acquire goods which lie outside and beyond that form of life, the achieving of which demand that it be transcendent. The form of life now appears as setting limits to the agent, limitations against which he must struggle and which he must overcome. What were horizons become barriers, but in so doing they play a positive role. They define the obstacles, the transcending of which is the contemporary achievement of freedom. For freedom is the core of characteristically human life. Hegel is not here quarreling with Aristotle or with Kant, who see man as essentially rational. What he believes is that human rationality has a history, and that its history is the criticism both in life and in thought of the limitations of each of its own specific historical forms. The negative, the limiting factors, the role of the horizon and the obstacle, these are what is original in Hegel. So the Hegelian methodological injunction about any epoch is understanding its life and thought in terms of its aims and goals, and understand its aims and goals by means of identifying what men saw as the obstacles in their path. You will then have identified their concept of freedom, even if they did not use the word freedom in that connection. By freedom, Hegel meant neither some property either possessed by Kant or available to the Stoics, all men, no matter what they did, nor some specific state of social life, J.S. Mill. What freedom is in each time and place is defined by the specific limitations of that time and place and by the characteristic goals of that time and place. So it is correct to say in the Hegelian sense that the levelers, the American colonists, John Brown at Harper's Ferry, and the South African Bantu today are all claiming their freedom, even though what they claim is substantially different in each case. To put it in another way, when we speak of man as being unfree, what we mean is always relative to an implicit normative picture of human life, by means of which we identify what human bondage is. And this is true not only of societies, but also of individuals. The Hegelian concept of freedom is equally relevant to the problem of political freedom and to the traditional philosophical free will problem. We have already encountered fragments of this problem in Aristotle and the Stoics, in Hobbes and in Kant. For Hobbes and Hume, to be free is to be unconstrained by external factors, by bonds or threats. The actions of both free and unfree are equally susceptible of causal explanation in terms of factors sufficient to produce their actions. So Hobbes and Hume insist that all human actions are determined, but that some are nonetheless free. Doubt about this account springs not so much from any belief that to be free is to be uncaused, as from the fact that, in certain cases, the discovery of a causal explanation for actions leads us to cease to blame the agent, to treat him as not responsible for his actions. There does, therefore, seem to be some connection between actions being free and their not having certain sorts of cause. What is needed here is an extension of the kind of investigation of words like voluntary and deliberate, which we find in Aristotle, to other expressions involved, and to provide this has been part of the original contribution of analytical philosophy in the 20th century. What Hegel does usefully point out is that the norms of voluntariness are not necessarily the same in all societies. The factors which we can demand of an agent that they should be under his control vary.